I apologize for ruining the nice fellowship that's going on. But we'll have more time for that after Bible study and then after services as well. Nice to be here with you all this evening. We just as people are getting settled, I'll tell you a quick story. Our future daughter-in-law is in town visiting with Pam and Melissa primarily. So they had a girls' afternoon yesterday. So Frederick, my son-in-law, and my grandson, we were on our own for dinner last night. So we did what most fellows will do. We made a gourmet meal. No, we actually got pizza. So we went to a little place we'd never been to before in Stowe. I forget what the name of the place is called, Giuseppe's or something like that. But Conrad, our little grandson, he's 2 and a half now, and he is all over the place. We came in the restaurant, and he noticed this little play area, and I didn't really see it, but we sat down, and so we're chatting, and he wanted to go play. And I said, "Well, Conrad, the only thing over there is the restrooms." And he said, no, play. So I said, "Well, let's order our food, and then we'll go look." Well, sure enough, the little play area, and this cartoon that someone gave me today reminded me of this, because it's a Dennis the Menace cartoon. And Dennis is in the back seat with his seatbelt on and his booster seat, and his parents are in front, and Dad is driving, and Dennis says, "By the time I'm old enough to drive, they'll all be self-driving cars." It's probably true. So they had one of those little driving, video games at this little place. And it's so great because Conrad doesn't know you have to put money in these things. So he was just as happy as can be. And the screen is flashing, and we'll have to monitor now how old he'll be before you realize that the screen just repeats itself over and over again until you put money in this machine. But he was the hit of the restaurant because after the food came, we went and sat down again, and the waitress brought this little pizza on a dish, kind of a stand. I don't know if you've seen those kind of places. It's kind of neat. It's up on a stand. And I guess that way you can just eat it without bending over. But just the cutest little guy. He doesn't get this often, but he was going, "Pizza! Pizza! Pizza!" And the whole restaurant's kind of going, "Wow, I wish my kid was so excited about pizza." So he was all about it. But more than pizza, he wanted to drive the car. Well, we are ready to roll for this morning, or this afternoon, I should say. Last Bible study, Mr. Smith had it by himself. And so we thought, when I gave this Bible study in Youngstown, that I would do about three quarters of it. Mrs. Smith would do the other quarter. But I ended up speaking longer. Not surprised. So rather than put two chairs up here and have Mr. Smith just sit there the whole hour, this way he can be back with the family and not have to do that. So we'll go ahead and ask God's blessing, and then we'll get started for today. So if you bow your heads. Our dear eternal Father, we bow ourselves before your throne today. We're so honored that we could be called at this time and brought into the truth and into your church. We're so very thankful, Father, you've given us a safe place to worship with people of like mind and like spirit. We're so very thankful, Father, for your church as a whole, and we ask your blessing on it. Of course, we've got a major building project going on. We ask your blessing and guidance with that so we might have a facility that will be better useful in serving you and serving your people. Please bless our Bible study today, Father, and encourage our minds to be open so that we might listen carefully to what you tell us through your word, and we might be able to apply it effectively in our lives. So we love you. We ask your blessing and inspiration and help, and we do so in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, we are ready to pick up in James chapter 4. We're getting close. We're thinking maybe one more James Bible study, and we might be able to wrap up the book of James. But Mr. Smith covered up to verse 11. And so that's where we'll pick it up today, James chapter 4 in verse 11. Now, before we jump into this section, remember that James earlier seemed to be pretty, if we could say it this way, upset with the church, with the brethren, because we looked about, or we went through quite a bit of detail in chapter 2, how they were showing preference, favoritism. And he was pretty insistent that just should not be done. And you kind of get the same feel that this portion of the epistle is kind of corrective when we get down to this section in chapter 4, verse 11. Because it begins by saying, do not, and again, when you get to that do not, this is an important statement. Do not speak evil of one another, brethren. Now, can you imagine that there were actually brethren who were speaking evil about each other? We're all kind of half smiling. Yeah, I think I could relate to that. Maybe I've heard it before. Maybe I've participated in it before. But he simply says, do not speak evil of one another. So it's brethren speaking evil about other members of God's family. The word for speak evil, kata laleo, laleo is to speak, kata is to speak against or evil of. So kata laleo means to speak against one. I love this definition because it uses two words we're unfamiliar with. The definition is to speak against one, or to criminate, or to traduce. And you're probably saying, well, I've heard of incriminate on the police shows. I don't want to incriminate myself, so I'm going to keep my mouth shut. But criminate is not a word we use very often. So I thought it would be helpful to look at that word, to criminate, to katalaleo, to speak evil of. It means to prove a person guilty of a crime. So to incriminate myself would be, I'm bringing evidence against myself, so I'm going to keep my mouth shut. But to criminate, in other words, to speak evil of, means to already have made a judgment. We are proving a person guilty already. That's the issue. To represent a thing or action as criminal, to censure, to condemn. So we're condemning. So when we say speak evil of, it's in the sense of condemning others. It goes on to say this. A third definition of criminate, to accuse of or charge with a crime, to denounce. As verbs, the difference between incriminate and criminate is that incriminate is to accuse or bring criminal charges against, while criminate is to impeach. In other words, we've already made a judgment. Already made the judgment. So to traduce means to speak badly of or tell lies about someone so as to damage their reputation. So when we talk here, when James is saying don't speak evil of others in the church, he's talking about do not judge in the sense of you're guilty. I saw what you did. I already know why you did it. You're guilty. Now, we've said before, there's always a backstory. We can see something. You know the old saying, seeing is believing? Not true. It's just not true. Because when we see something, we see it with a certain lens, and we make a judgment based on our lens, not necessarily the circumstance. All right, we've used that example before. Mr. Hawk walks out of a bar in the middle of the day. We happen to be driving by. Remember that? Yeah, you all remember that example. Isn't that interesting? Probably because it's so wild. But we see it through our filter. So we can see someone, and again, even today, much more so, you go to the movies. Is seeing believing? Wow, they can make awesome things seem like they're really happening. And what you might have is a person or two in front of a green screen, and they're the only real things about this entire movie is the two or three people involved. Everything else is generated in a fantasy world. So seeing is not believing. So we can see someone do something or think we overhear a conversation and we make a judgment. We speak evil of others based on that, and it may be completely and totally wrong, just completely outside of what is actually happening. So one of the cautions that James is emphasizing here is our requirement to uphold the brethren, to uphold the brotherhood. We are unique people. And of all people, we ought to be giving each other the benefit of the doubt. We ought to be building each other up. Who needs encouragement more than God's people? And the people out there are just living their own way. And sure, we can encourage those people out there. At the same time, who needs strengthening? Who needs encouragement? Who does not need to be spoken evil of? Well, it's God's people. So we have an obligation to uphold the brotherhood. And do not allow yourself to speak evil or speak ill of or slander a brother or sister in the faith. We certainly don't want to be guilty of that. And again, when he says, do not speak evil of one another, he was addressing the brethren. He was addressing the church. So in this case, not only were the people that James writing to showing favoritism based on outward appearance, they were also speaking evil of each other. Now, it may not have been everybody in the congregation, but a lot of this was going on, so much so that he felt it was important to address this. So this kind of damaging speech, these accusations, this slander, that was tearing apart the body of Christ, and he wanted to be sure that that was brought to their attention so they might stop that. So do not speak evil of one another. The only two times other than this scripture where this word is used, kataleo, it is used of those on the outside of the church speaking evil about those inside the church. So what we can glean from that is that if we're speaking evil of, if we're saying, well, do you know what they're like? You know what they did? You know what? I can imagine that they're, you know, we're speaking like a worldly person, as if God's Spirit is not influencing us at all. So we want to be very careful with that. We don't want to be speaking like an outsider to the faith, to the truth. Then it says, do not speak evil of one another, brethren. He who speaks evil of a brother and judges his brother. We pause for a second there. That's, again, speaking evil of, the same concept. But evil of a brother, of all the people we ought to be given the benefit of the doubt of, it's brethren, it's our family. But it says, judges his brother. The Greek word for judges here is krino, K-R-I-N-O, krino. And it means to distinguish, to decide mentally or judicially, by implication, to try, condemn, and punish. To condemn, to damn, to determine, judge. In other words, we've already made a decision. And so we think about it. You can reflect on sometimes the things that we might have said about others. And is it in this vein where we've already condemned the person? If there's someone here, you can think, yeah, I know it. They're not very spiritual. I know what they're like. You know them. You know, they'll talk. Yeah, they're just, and we've already made this judgment. And James will go on to say, boy, if we're judging them, we are in a league that we have no right being in at all. And he'll talk about that. So inherent in this kind of judging or speaking evil of our brother is, it says, we judge our brother, what are we setting ourselves up as? Well, we're the judge. We now are the sole determiner of Christian behavior. And we can decide one's righteousness or not. Now, is that possible? No, it's something I think I've mentioned before, but it just hit me like a ton of bricks. In 1995, we all went through, those who were around, went through the horrible situation we did, the doctrinal confusion that went on, and the terrible just betrayal of the truth by the church itself. Who would have ever expected the church could betray the truth? But it was certain individuals. And as that took place, you know, here we are. I remember doing, at the time I was doing Bible study on the book of Galatians. And one of the members came up and said, what do you do if your pastor is not teaching what headquarters is saying? You call headquarters. I'm not going to hide this. It's what I teach. But what I thought I had sorted out was, I pretty much know who's going to survive this one. And then to find out a couple weeks later when we began our first non-worldwide Church of God church service, we weren't another church yet. We were just the bunch of people who still wanted to pursue the truth and live the truth and learn the truth. And I was really surprised because there were people that I would absolutely have put money on. Of course they're going to be faithful. And they weren't. And there were people I kind of thought, yeah, I don't know if they're going to make it. And there they are, still to this day, as faithful as can be. So what did I learn? I'm an idiot. I can't judge those things, even if I think I can. And the words that God told Samuel just ring in your head. Humans, you know, you humans, your problem is you judge by the outward appearance. Well, why? Because we can't do anything else. We can't see the heart. God says, no, I judge by the heart. So he's not necessarily condemning Samuel. He's just saying, you don't have the abilities to be able to judge the heart. You just don't, because you can't see the heart. We can look at an outside action, but does that judge the heart? Not necessarily. Who would have judged David to have God's spirit when he was in the middle of the Bathsheba and Uriah thing? No, we would have said, he's not part of that. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's not converted. Well, sorry, he was. So when we set ourselves up as judge and we speak evil of others, we're literally putting ourselves in God's seat. And that's a dangerous place for us to think we can put ourselves. So that's what he goes on to describe in the rest of the verse. He says, he who speaks evil of a brother and judges his brother, then he says this, speaks evil of the law and judges the law. Now, how is that possible? What are he's saying, if you condemn one of your brothers or sisters in the faith, you speak evil of them, you are speaking evil of the law and you're judging the law. What does that mean? How do we judge the law? What he's saying in essence is that if we speak evil of others, we're telling God that his prescription against this kind of speech is unimportant, number one. No, God, I can sort this out. I can see the heart. I can make a judgment about them because I know. What do we know? No, we don't. We really don't know. So we decide that this law against evil speaking is unnecessary and it's unbinding. And we, like Adam and Eve, decide for ourselves the right to determine right and wrong. Well, God, I know you say don't judge, but look at this person. Look what they're doing. Look what they said to me. Look what they said to someone else. Look what sin they committed. And we set ourselves up as judge. So we determine that the law is decided by us. We judge the law. We'll decide what should be law and what shouldn't be. And that's, again, a dangerous place to be. We're actually speaking evil of God's law. In this way, we judge the law. And then he finishes the verse by saying, speaks evil of the law, judges the law, and not a doer of the law, but a judge. So he's saying the law is set by God. And we have one option, obey or disobey. That's it. Not to decide whether or not it should be a law. Right? We come to a stop sign. We have one choice, obey or disobey. Not, you know, I'm not so sure the stop sign is such a good idea. You know, in my case, I'll decide for myself. Okay, I hope you have good insurance, right? So again, that's the point he's making. If we judge the law, speaking evil of others, we're setting ourselves as God, and we say, you know, I'll decide whether or not that's an appropriate action, whether that's a good thing to do or not. We have no right to decide what law is and what law is not. That is God's area. We simply have the opportunity to obey or disobey. We're working with our grandson because he's 2.5, and everybody knows what they call the twos, right? It doesn't start with wonderful, delightful twos. It's usually the word terrible goes along with twos. Not that the kids are bad, but they've reached this another little cognitive level, and this is a level of independence, and I can do it myself, and I want to do these things. So Meemaw's been working with Conrad, you know, listen and obey. So this morning, Conrad, you know, he didn't want to leave because he loves being with Meemaw at Meemaw's house. And Conrad, it's time to get your shoes on. And so I mouthed at Conrad. And so he went over and sat on his mommy's lap and said, "Yes, ma'am! Conrad is perfect, beautiful! I listened, I obeyed. Yes, how about a fist bump?" That's what we have the responsibility for. We're just little guys, like Conrad, getting our shoes on. God, I obeyed. I'm not going to sit here and judge the character of those that you're working with. That's not my job. That's your job. You can see the heart. I can't. If I speak evil of them, I am sinning. And yet it's so easy to make a determination before anything else goes on. We decide in our mind, snap judgment. Well, no wonder. Look at that person. I could have figured they'd do that. So verse 12 then says, there is one lawgiver, that's God. We don't want to put ourselves in God's position. There's one lawgiver who is able to save and destroy. That's his job. We can't save that person. We can't destroy that person. That's God. So he simply says in the rest of verse 12, who are you to judge another? We're way out of our league when it comes to that. Those are God's responsibilities. God and God alone has the right to determine law. He has the authority over all life. He has perfect judgment. He can see the heart. He can see the thoughts. Therefore, he can perfectly spare or condemn based upon complete and total knowledge and complete righteousness. So when you and I have gotten to that point where we have perfect judgment, where we can read the heart and the mind and see the thoughts before they're ever expressed, the way Christ did. What did he say about the Pharisees? He knew. He knew what they were thinking before they said it. And he said, I know what you're thinking. Don't think in your heart. And then he goes on to say, well, how did he know what was in my heart? Well, he's God. So when we get to that spot, great. You can do all the judging you want because you'll have that responsibility. That Paul says that in Corinthians, right? In 2 Corinthians 6. Don't you know you're going to judge angels? Are you going to judge angels next week? I don't think so. But once we're in God's family and he's given us eternal life and we have perfect judgment, we can see the heart. Well, yeah, we'll even have responsibility of deciding sentences for demons. I mean, we're going to judge righteous angels' actions and say, wow, great job. Thanks for all you did. And we're going to judge demons and say, you know, you belong where God is sending you. For that rebellion, you'll be able to judge perfectly. So that's what Paul says. Don't you know, why are we having these kind of troubles now in the church? Don't you realize you're going to be taking these responsibilities later on? These are heavy responsibilities. So James asks, can we do this? Can we judge another? Who are we to judge? Now it's interesting when he says there's one lawgiver who's able to save and destroy. In essence, what we're talking about is when we speak evil of another and we pass judgment on them, we're really kind of slicing them up and we're destroying them. We can destroy their reputation. We can cause others to think badly about them. Have you ever seen that? Where you didn't have much of a problem with another person, but then someone else comes and just enters doubt, throws some doubt in there. Well, you know, I'm wondering about, what do you think? And sometimes, if a person has an issue with another, they can start saying something like that, and then that question is there. Like, well, I didn't have any question before, but I'm kind of wondering. I'm kind of watching now. Well, maybe they're right. And this lack of trust then enters into the situation and it starts to fester. Yeah, I can see what they're saying. It's been well noted in various situations. An excellent book called, I think it's called The Importance of Trust, or The Development of Trust, but just what a critical thing is to develop trust and maintain that trust and work on that. So we certainly don't want to destroy someone else's reputation and cause others then to really question their motives and question their spirituality and question their position in the church, etc. So James is very clear about this. He's a little bit upset, very, very much so, about what's going on in the church. He says, stop speaking evil of each other. So we can learn certainly from that as well. Now he goes on to emphasize this principle by showing how small we really are, to show why taking God's prerogative to judge is just so wrong on our behalf. So don't step into God's shoes. And then he says this in verse 13, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we'll go to such and such a city, spend a year there, buy and sell and make a profit." So again, what he's emphasizing, he's giving support information now to emphasize we should not be judging each other, should not be speaking evil of each other. That's God's department. We should not be speaking evil. Now he gives this illustration. You say, tomorrow I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to take care of my business, I'm going to make a profit, do my stuff. Verse 14, "Whereas you do not know what will happen tomorrow." In other words, you're going to set yourself in God's seat and make a spiritual judgment about others, and you don't even know if you're going to be alive tomorrow. That's what he's saying. How dare we step into God's shoes as an eternal judge when we could die tonight? That's his point. Well, you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. For what is your life? Rest of verse 14. "It is even a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. You are not, I am not the eternal God, able to make spiritual judgments about other people's character." And yet sometimes in the church we've been really good at that. And sometimes you can tell when that dynamic is set up, because it becomes very much a surface kind of situation. And there's a lot of nipping about stuff on the surface. You know, okay, his hair is a little over his ears. We know what that means. Yeah, he just doesn't get the picture. Now, some of us wish we could still grow hair over our ears. Oh, her skirt is not at her calves. We know what that means. You know, too bad. So we set up this whole dynamic that we're judged on the outward appearance. And that's the kind of dynamic that is set up when we get into this idea. Now, that's not to say there isn't a proper standard of hair and there isn't a proper standard of dress. We all know that's the case. But we set up a very physical type of picture. I mean, some of you have been around long enough to remember the days where a young teenage girl would have to kneel down at church to show that her skirt touched the ground when she kneeled, to show it was long enough. And that was righteous. Now, it wasn't in every congregation, but anybody remember those days? Anybody experienced that? Maybe a couple? Thankfully, not many. But that's how you knew. Now, does that say anything about the head or the heart? Well, nothing. Virtually nothing. I mean, it might indicate things, but it might not. It might have nothing to do with it. So, again, we can set up this very physical standard. So, James is simply saying, look, we don't even know we're going to be alive tomorrow. And you presume to put yourself in God's position and make a spiritual judgment about someone's heart? So your life's just going to vanish away. So we may have these grandiose plans that we would like to accomplish. And many times we take these two scriptures, verses 13 and 14, we kind of pull them out of context. It's not a bad thing. But we take them as a principle by themselves, and that's not a bad thing. But in the context, it's you're judging someone else when you are a vapor? What right does a vapor have to judge somebody else? You know, it's like exhaling, we're gone. What did someone say recently? That the days are long, but the years are short. Ask anybody who's retirement age. Man, how'd you ever get to retirement age? And they'll say, I have no idea. Yesterday I was 20. I don't know what happened. It just happened all of a sudden. There we are. So his point is, you're a breath. Do not condemn. Do not judge your brother. Do not speak evil of them. We need each other's help and encouragement and support. We don't need speaking evil. Now, again, we take these verses out of their context, and they're a very valid principle of and by themselves. That here we are, we're just people. And what we can draw from this is that God has our back. God is directing our lives. He is overseeing our future. We have plans that we'd like to accomplish, but we have to remember we are mortal. We are temporary creatures. We can't ensure that we'll be alive tomorrow. So if we are making all these wonderful plans without considering that God is overseeing everything, then we become kind of arrogant. And that's what he'll mention along the way here. We become kind of arrogant, that we separate ourselves from God, and I've got all these plans. Now, again, he's not saying, we read in verse 14, instead you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and do this or that. He's not saying don't plan for the future, but we plan with the big picture in mind, that God is in control, that we are totally dependent upon him. We might not even be alive tomorrow if it weren't for him. So we don't, in our arrogance, simply say, well, this is all mine. And like the guy in Luke 12, you know, I got all this stuff. I don't have big enough barns to store all my stuff. So I'm going to go downtown to self-store because I need to store more stuff. We have a self-storage place almost across the way from where we live. And I think it's called Stop and Store. And they've got all these little cubicles, you know, that people rent out and put their junk in. Now, I don't know for sure, but I'm guessing if we totaled the value of everything in that entire complex, we'd have a few thousand dollars worth of stuff. I don't think anybody stores gold there or diamonds, right? I don't have room for my great-grandmother's chest of drawers. Or whatever, I don't know what they put in there, but about every couple of months, somebody hasn't paid their bill. And so out on the street, on the highway, is stuff. It's people's furniture, it's clothes, it's an ironing board, and they just put it out for the trash because nobody wants it. And you're thinking, who was paying money to store that stuff? Like, why would you do that? Get rid of the stuff. Okay, that's a whole other thing. Point is, he's not saying that every time we speak, we should say, well, if God wills, we'll live long enough to do this or that. He's not saying that that's what we have to repeat, because you maybe have known people like that. Hey, see you next Sabbath. And they'll say, if the Lord wills. Like, that's kind of weird. Why are you saying that? It just sounds very spiritual, though. If God wills. Yeah. I'm much more spiritual than you are, obviously, because you're just saying, see you next week. I'm saying, if the Lord wills. So he's not saying that. But he is saying that each and every day a Christian should have a sense of God's presence, of God's authority over our lives. Yes, we make plans, but always with the understanding that our plans may not fit into the overarching will of God for us. He will guide and direct as he sees fit. So the proverb in Proverbs 3 that talks about you make your plans, but make sure God is in the middle of all that, that you're asking him for insight and wisdom and direction, then we're doing fine. So we don't constantly say, if the Lord wills, but we show that there's an attitude and approach that God is in charge. We will always yield to him. We want his direction. We want his guidance. So in the midst of this, please don't speak evil of each other. You can't even know if you're going to be alive tomorrow. So don't put yourself in God's shoes. So he uses this example to show that we're very temporary. And again, to think otherwise turns into a kind of arrogance. And he says that next in verse 16. But now, he said, you boast in your arrogance. Now, again, what's the context? People were speaking evil of others in the faith, others in the church. And he says, you know what? That comes down to boastful arrogance. Because what happens? If I judge somebody else, what am I saying about myself? I'm not like him. I'm not like her. You know, it's the Pharisee in the temple with the tax collector. And instead of saying, God, thank you for not killing me today because I deserved it, what is the Pharisee doing? Whoa, look it over there. I'm sorry, Terry, didn't mean to point at you. Look it over there. There's the publican. I'm sure glad I'm not like him. What's that? It's arrogance. See, I am righteous. Therefore, I have the ability to judge everybody else and sit in God's seat. Excuse me, God, you're taking up my spot. I'll judge this person and let you know what my decision is. It's arrogance to think we can sit in God's seat and make those kind of judgments. So he says, all such boasting is evil. So he said, when you speak evil of someone else, it's actually a kind of boasting about ourselves. Because we have already determined that I am righteous and they are obviously not. Therefore, they should be condemned. And look at what they're doing. And we spread evil things about others. So the current situation and attitude, James says, is you're arrogant. You're stepping into God's realm of power and authority. And he said that's simply evil. All such boasting is evil. Now, in verse 16 where it says, you boast now in your arrogance. The word arrogance is defined this way, an impious, an empty presumption which trusts in the stability of earthly things. Other translations render it vaunting. Yeah, again, vaunting is, a helpful translation. Revised Standard does it that way because it's putting us up. See, when we speak evil of others, we put ourselves up and we put them down. So again, we're sitting in God's seat. So he says all of that is just arrogance. It shouldn't be done. So verse 17, therefore, to him who knows to do good and does it not, or does not do it, to him it is sin. And again, this is a verse that we'll take out for out of the initial context for other principles. But it's in the context of this speaking evil. In other words, James says, I've just given you the instruction. I've shown you the reason behind it, the reason it leads this. You put yourself in God's seat. It's a bad thing. It's an evil thing. Now that you know that, he says, if you don't do it, you're sinning. So in one sense, he's saying, look, I understand that up to this point, you might not really have gotten it. You might not really have understood that when you speak evil of someone else, here's what you're doing. So now he's saying, now that you know that, you know what's good. If you don't do it, it's sin. That's the context in which he says this. So now that we know it, we've been reminded, wow, for the next couple months, this ought to be the most delightful and loving and supportive congregation in the world because we've just gone over God's instruction that way. Then let's take this principle and lift it out of the context in which it's written. If we look at this, there's only a few times in the Bible that sin is defined in a very simple and clear manner. Sin is. Only a couple times, and this is one of them. We all are familiar with 1 John 3:4. Sin is what? The transgression or the breaking of God's law. We all know that. This is another sin is definition. So if we want to know what sin is, here's another definition. Sin is knowing what is right, what is good, and not doing it. Not doing it. So sin on one hand, 1 John 3:4, is breaking God's law. Sin here is defined as not doing what we're supposed to be doing. So in the church, we've often divided sin into kind of two aspects. One is sin of commission. We commit sin. We have God's law and we break it. We commit sin. And then we have the other one that's hinted at here, the sin of omission. So we have commission and omission. Omission is, I should have done what was right and I didn't do it. So you might immediately think of the principle of the poor fellow who is robbed and beaten on his way to Jericho. And what happens? Levi comes by, and here's this poor guy laying in the ditch. He's half dead. And the Levite commits a sin of omission. He knew what was right. Here's someone hurting. I should help. And he walked on by. Priest, the same thing. He knew what he should do and walked on by. It was sin. To know what we should do and not do it is sin. To know what is right and break God's law is a sin as well. So sins of omission, things that we've left out, things that we should have been doing, and sins of commission, things that we shouldn't have done that we did. So you understand the principle there. So if we know to do good and don't do it, then that is sin as well. So you and I probably ask God just as often for forgiveness with regard to omission as we probably do commission. I don't know what the balance might be in your life, but we ask God sometimes, well, I should have done something there. I should have called. I should have stopped by. Please forgive me for neglecting what I should have been doing. Very common. Keep your marker here in James chapter 4. A couple other scriptures we'll take a quick look at. Psalm 52. Psalm 52. In the first four verses, David is says here a contemplation of David. He was kind of sitting and thinking this through, and he writes this song. If I ever mentioned it, I had a friend in the church. He and another woman who was not in the church kind of thought they'd figured out the musical notation of the Psalms, and it's very Hebraic and very harp-like and things like that. Maybe I mentioned this before. He's a fine fellow. I really enjoyed him. He's quite a talented pianist as well. But he thought they had kind of figured out all the musical notation. And so he sent me about a half a dozen psalms that he and this woman had performed and sung to. She did the singing and he did the playing on the harp. And I sent him a note back, said, you know, really appreciate the effort that's gone into us, but you know, John, I don't think you got it yet, because it was a song of joy, and it just sounded like it was a funeral, like, praise the Lord, oh, rejoice, all ye people. Oh, I'm already crying. I'm supposed to be rejoicing. John, that can't be right. So I said, keep working on it. No, God hid the musical notation for a reason. So here's David. He's playing this hymn. And he says, I can imagine this is a pretty moving song, I think. I wonder. Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? You think you're somebody? That's kind of what he's saying. The goodness of God endures continually. I get from that. Here's this guy boasting. And David is saying, you know, you're lucky you're still alive. The fact that you still draw breath shows how good God is. There's a different approach there. Instead of, oh, I'm somebody, I can tell whether you're spiritual. I can tell whether you're righteous. I can tell whether you're being obedient to God. I can tell what your heart is like. He says, it's the fact that God is so good that you're still alive, all of us. Your tongue devises destruction like a sharp razor working deceitfully. You love evil more than good, lying rather than speaking righteousness. Selah, or so be it. You love all devouring words, you deceitful tongue. You think some of this might be some of the inspiration that James took off on and God used as James was composing those scriptures about the tongue and about speaking evil of each other, that he would have understood some of these things, written them down. Turn to the book of Luke, chapter 6. None of us want to be like that uses our tongue to devise destruction, like a razor that cuts. Luke chapter 6, in verse 45. Here's kind of the opposite we want to remember when it comes to these issues of speaking evil of one another. If, as we've gone through this portion of the Bible study, you think that, wow, there's some times that really, really have blown this, really have not done well. The issue really is not then, as we strive to change, the issue is not, I just have to bite my tongue. I'm going to be bloody tongue pretty often. The issue really is the heart. So if we find ourselves having been a part of this, then what we want to ask God for is to change our heart because of what is stated here. Luke 6 and verse 45. a good man, out of the good treasure of his heart, brings forth good. So that's what we're looking for. We want to bring forth good. So if we find ourselves having been speaking evil of others, we ask God to help change our heart so that it naturally brings out things that are good rather than evil speaking. Good man out of the good treasure of his heart brings forth good, and evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart brings forth evil. For out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaks, or his mouth speaks. So we ask God to change our heart, to give us that pure and clean heart that gives the benefit of the doubt, that even when someone is guilty, it's kind and it's gentle and it's supportive and it's trying to help a person change as opposed to condemning them. So we have this biblical definition of sin. To know what is good and not do it is sin. So if we head back to the book of James, while you're turning there, we're ready to start chapter 5. I'll read to you that last verse, verse 17, in a couple different translations. The New Living Translation puts it this way. Remember, it is sin to know what you ought to do and then not do it. Pretty clear. The English Standard Version. So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin. I mean, if we know better, don't do it, it's sin. International Children's Bible says this, and when a person knows the right thing to do but does not do it, then he is sinning. So when it comes to this issue in context again of speaking evil of others, we know what we ought to do. So hopefully our conscience becomes more tuned to these things, and when we're ready to speak evil of someone and judge them, pass a sentence on them, then we can stop in process. It reminds me, it's worth taking a moment to remind ourselves that there's always a backstory. And I need to move along if we're going to get through the rest of it. There's always a backstory. There's always something in the background. And you probably know of any number of circumstances over the course of time. Remember years ago, Mr. Antion gave an example in one of his messages. He's giving a sermon, and he sees this lady sitting toward the back, and she has got her eyes closed, and she is obviously snoring away. I mean, he's a pretty animated speaker. So to have someone snoring through one of his messages, he said, it just started to make me mad. So I spoke a little louder. Didn't change. Spoke a little louder. Didn't change. So after the sermon, he said, closing prayer, I went right back there to talk to this woman. You can't be sleeping during church. What are you, staying up too late on Friday nights? What's going on? So he gets back there and he greets her. And she immediately says, oh, Mr. Antion, I am so sorry. She said, I have had a miserable migraine for the last 2 days, but I was not going to let that keep me from coming to church. These lights are just really hard. If you've been one with migraines, fluorescent lights are terrible for that. It's really hard on a person. And he said, I felt horrible because I had already judged and condemned her. I was going back there to correct this woman. And I learned that, wow, what an attitude. She was in suffering pain, but she was coming to church anyway, in spite of that. There's always a backstory. We may not know what the backstory is, but that's one of the reasons we cannot judge, because we just honestly don't know. And something that would strike us one way, you know, some people are just a little more prickly than others. Is that true? I know people who are prickly. My wife is looking at me. That's right. Can be a little prickly at times, right? What's the back? Well, there might be a backstory. Yeah, probably is. So let's give the benefit of the doubt. Let's speak evil of each other. Let's support the brotherhood. We really need to be doing that. All right, chapter 5. Chapter 5, come now, you rich. And it seems to be a logical kind of thought break or chapter break here. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. Now again, if in fact James was writing to the lost sheep of the house of Israel who were doing fairly well elsewhere in the world as they moved up across the area of the Black Sea and Caspian Sea and toward Europe, they were doing well. Maybe that's who he's writing to. But it applies to everyone. Certainly if there were those in the congregation who were wealthy, that congregations that he may have been writing to, his point was, don't trust in riches. Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you. So, reminiscent of what Christ said, you know, it's just difficult for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven. He said it's harder for a rich person to enter the kingdom of heaven than it is a camel to go through the eye of a needle. And the disciples are kind of looking at that and said, well, that's not even possible. And Christ is saying, that's my point. With men, it is impossible. But for God, you know, he can shrink that camel and stuff it through the eye of the needle and rehydrate it on the other side, and it's a camel again. God can do these things. So, again, the wealthy, again, what do? They tend to trust in themselves. They've got lots of ability. They've got lots of savvy when it comes to business things. So they can tend to think a little bit more highly of themselves than they ought. You might jot down as a companion scripture, Proverbs 11, verse 4. Riches do not profit in the day of wrath, but righteousness delivers from death. So he's not saying it's wrong to be wealthy, but it's our opinion. It's how we deal with it. It's our approach toward it. If we understand it's just stuff and we can use it to help others, we're probably going in the right direction. Verse 2, chapter 5, verse 2. Your riches are corrupted, and your garments are moth-eaten. Doesn't help in the long run to have stuff. Again, we can use stuff in a very good way to help others, to serve, to care for our family. All those things are wonderful. Again, a companion scripture you might jot down, Matthew chapter 6, in verse 19 to 21. A Sermon on the Mount, don't lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust is corrupt, etc., etc. Lay up yourself treasures in heaven. That's the important thing. So we can use our things to serve others, and that's a good use of riches and wealth. It's a good thing. But if we're not being generous toward God and toward others, then we have a real problem. Verse 3, your gold and silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. A couple things there. First of all, gold and silver do not corrode. So why is he even saying this? Well, he's saying it's just like a hunk of metal. Get a piece of steel, what's going to happen? Bury it for a week or two or three. What happens? It's falling apart and rust. So he's saying that's just as temporary. Even though silver and gold don't technically rust or corrode, that's one of the reasons they're so valuable. He said it's just like the other stuff. It's just physical stuff. It may be shinier. Other people may pay you more for it, but it's just stuff. And in the long run, it does you no good whatsoever. There's no spiritual value to that in any way. So your gold and silver are corroded. Verse 3, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You've heaped up treasure in the last days. Now when it says your gold and silver will be a witness against you, in other words, they've become worthless. You've put all your time and effort into the stuff and it's worthless. Now there's coming a time when it says they're going to throw their gold and silver in the street. Well, why would they do that? Because there's nothing to buy. And if there's no food, it doesn't matter how much gold you have, there's no food to buy. That's why people will throw their gold and silver in the street, because there's nothing there. When God's time comes, it'll be a pretty impressive time. God will be pretty serious about these things. When it says it'll eat your flesh like fire, I can think of one circumstance that put me in mind of this. In 2008, we had pretty difficult financial year in the United States. And probably 90% of you are saying, didn't really notice. There were others, though. If you had money and you had lots of investments, 2008 was a disaster where some people lost 30, 40, 50, 60% of their retirement fund to thieves who stole it. Idiots who stole it. I mean, they take all these loans, they package them together, and they were making so much money on these home mortgages they packaged together that banks said, wow, we want to make more money. So let's give mortgages to people who really shouldn't have houses. Let's make sure they get in a house. In fact, we'll give them not just 100% of the value of the house in a mortgage. We'll give them 120% of the value of the house in a mortgage. They have no ability to really pay it, but then I can package this loan, sell it to an investor, and man, the profits were huge. Until you say, well, wait a second. How's that person who couldn't afford a house to begin with, how are they going to pay that mortgage? Well, they didn't. So all these mortgages go belly up in the whole system. We just about collapsed the world economy in 2008. And again, most people say, well, it didn't really bother me. Well, it's because we didn't have investments like that. But the people who did, that was eating their flesh like fire. Like, all I've worked for. And most of that stuff on paper anyway. I put $10,000 in there, and now they're telling me it's worth $80,000. It's not really. Nobody's going to give you $80,000 at that moment. Oh, if you do, you might be pretty good. You can sell it quickly and get the money. But it's most of that's just paper. It's just air. And when all that air disappeared, it's so here we had our trust in all these riches, and now they're gone. Well, again, God's time to deal with America isn't yet. Because since 2008, things have improved pretty dramatically. So it's not time yet, but there will come a time when that crash is going to happen, and it's never going to recover, not in this age. And if our trust is in those things, we're of all men most miserable. Got to be trusting God, putting our gold in spiritual things, then we'll be fine. Let's continue on. We can finish this section in the next 3.5 minutes. Psalm 119, you can jot this down, verse 72. David says, the law of your mouth is better to me than 1,000 coins of gold and silver. Psalm 119, verse 72. The law of your mouth is better to me than 1,000 coins of gold and silver. David understood what was really, really valuable. And that was the truth, not stuff. So continue on in James chapter 5. In verse 4, he says, indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out. So again, he's condemning the rich people because they were taking advantage of the poor. And it's like the money you have in the bank is screaming out. It kind of puts you in mind of Abel's blood, where God said, you know, Cain, your brother's blood is crying out to me. I mean, it's not that the blood was actually crying or this money is actually crying out. But this should not be in your bank account. It should be in the pockets of the people who are laboring for you. That's where it belongs. You've taken advantage of them. You've defrauded them. And that money is going to eat holes in your pocket because it shouldn't be there. The cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. In other words, it's crying. You taking advantage of the poor is not a good thing to do. The word Sabaoth, only a couple times used in the New Testament. And it means the Lord of hosts. It has nothing to do with the Sabbath. It sounds like Sabbath. But it has nothing to do with the weekly Sabbath or rest. It means the Lord of hosts, the Lord of armies. So James is saying, if you're taking advantage of the poor, you know who's hearing? The God who has all the armies in the world. You don't want to be on his bad side. Because he's the Lord of hosts. And what does a general do? He commands his armies to take care of things. So you don't want to be on God's bad side. You want to take care of those who need to be taken care of. So their dishonesty, their oppression was being seen by God, and he was going to call them into account for that. You could jot down Romans 12 and verse 9. It's the only other time this word Sabaoth is used in the New Testament. Romans 12 and verse 9. Unless the Lord of Sabaoth has left us a seed, we would become like Sodom and we have been made like Gomorrah. So he said, unless God, who controls all the armies, would show us favor, we'd be like Sodom and Gomorrah. We'd be all out of it. So Lord of hosts is used hundreds of times in the Old Testament. And again, it's a symbol of God's power and authority. He commands hosts. Remember what Christ said when it came time for him to be arrested? He said, "Don't you think I could call 12 legions of angels? Boom! And they would be here to defend me?" Peter, put the sword away. "You're not going to defend me. If I want defense, I will call on the angels." So they are the God of hosts. Power is there. From there, verse 5, "You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter." An echo of Lazarus and the rich man. You know, you've lived in this life with great pleasure, great abundance, but you haven't helped anybody. So very clear, if you want to jot down that reference, Luke 16. Luke 16, verses 19 to 31, the parable of Lazarus and the rich man. So again, we have to ask ourselves the questions, how much is enough? And am I setting aside something to help others? Am I setting anything aside to help others? It's a good thing that Christians ought to be doing. Again, God's word in the Old Testament is very clear about that as well. If you're oppressing your brother, not helping them, if someone cries out to you, they have a need, we ought to try to help. So each of us has to kind of sort through that in our own lives, what we're able to do and what we might be able to help with. You might jot down Deuteronomy 24, verses 14 and 15. Deuteronomy 24, verses 14 and 15. "You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether one of your brethren or one of the aliens who is in your land within your gates. Each day you shall give him his wages and not let the sun go down on it, for he is poor and has set his heart on it, lest he cry out against you to the Eternal and be sin to you." I mean, the typical laborer at that time worked, received their pay, went to the market to buy food for dinner. They didn't have refrigerators to store a lot of things. They might have a grain bin or some of those things, but didn't have refrigeration. One thing we noticed when we went to the Netherlands, at least in that part of Europe, very small stuff. So they have like a little dorm refrigerator. They don't have 37 cubic foot space refrigerators that have scads of a grocery store full of food in them like we do. We saw this one fridge. It reminded us of the Millennium Falcon. You kind of open it up and it's, ooh, all these light, this lighting comes on. Wow, this is really cool. So I can see what's rotting in the back of my refrigerator. But they have these little fridges. So what do? They go to the store every day. My son-in-law's mother rides her bicycle to the store every day. It's just a different way of thinking of things. And much more, and these people were the same way. I go to the store every day to get my stuff. So I need my money to be able to do that. So don't take advantage of them. They're struggling the way it is. Pay them a decent wage and see if you can help them along the way. Goes on to say in verse 6, "You have condemned, you have murdered the just. He does not resist you." Now, this could be, as we mentioned back in chapter 1, a general reference to the fighting and warring that was going on in chapter 4, the general warring that was going on in Israel at the time. Because, again, chapter 1 says he was writing to the nations of Israel, to the people of Israel, the scattered of Israel, the diaspora, the scattered out there. So if that's the case, he may be referring to that as well. You know, you're just murdering the just, you're condemning others. But it also could be very much a direct reference to Christ. That because of their attitudes of taking advantage of others, speaking evil of others, you're in essence killing the just. So it could be a reference in part to, you know, we speak evil of each other, it's like we're murdering them. It could also be a reference directly to Jesus Christ. And that probably is likely at least part of what James was thinking. Because it says, "He does not resist you." And "he" probably is a reference to Christ. They murdered the just by their behavior, by their... They didn't literally pull the spear and stab him or nail him up there, but they were in essence responsible for it, just like we are. But he says he does not resist you. In other words, just because there's no resistance now doesn't mean there isn't going to be. And I think that's a principle that it's worth taking the time to look at. We'll close here by turning to Isaiah chapter 2. Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 12. Because here is describing the time of God's intervention when he will resist evil. He says he does not resist. Now is not the time where God is resisting the evil. He's letting it play out, letting them do their own thing. And because, as Solomon said, judgment does not come swiftly, people think there is no judgment. But there is. Isaiah chapter 2 and verse 12, there'll come a time when God will rise to bring justice to the earth. For the day of the Lord of hosts, verse 12, Isaiah 2, 12, shall come upon everything proud and lofty, upon everything lifted up, and it shall be brought low. There is coming a time, verse 13, upon all the cedars of Lebanon that are high and lifted up. Cedars are a representation of leadership and kings, and all those mighty, high and mighty, we might say, upon all the oaks of Bashan, these monstrous trees that seem so strong and stable, they're coming down. Verse 14, upon all the high mountains, upon all the hills that are lifted up, that arrogance again, upon every high tower, upon every fortified wall, upon all the ships of Tarshish, upon all the beautiful sloops, the loftiness of man shall be bowed down. When you take these giant ships that would travel the oceans, and they're pretty impressive. Well, today we say, well, that's nothing compared to a cargo ship, a container ship that can carry thousands and thousands and thousands of tons of stuff all around the world. That's pretty impressive. One storm, God can take care of those. It's not hard for him. It says, the haughtiness of men shall be brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day, but the idols he shall utterly abolish. They, meaning the people, will go into holes of the rocks and the caves of the earth from the terror of the Lord and the glory of his majesty. When he arises to shake the earth mightily. Now we can go on from there, we won't. But the point is, there will be a time of God's intervention when he will resist those who do evil. So today is not our time to resist those who do evil. Some people with a very generous heart try to think, well, now is the time we need to straighten out this whole world. We need to do things that will make this world right. Well, it's not going to happen. We can do our part to do the best we can. Set an example, shine a light, but we're not likely going to fix the world. We've got a friend of ours. He used to play violin in the same little orchestra as my daughter. And he's doing a very good thing. He's got this dried fruit company, making fruit leather, as we call it. Nice guy. Served in the Peace Corps a couple years down in South America, and he got to know these natives, and they grow akasi, whatever that stuff is. And they grow these things, and now so he's worked out a really neat thing where they get the stuff from there and they dry it and then they ship it up here, but then they can't ship it. And he's doing nice thing. It's just really cool. He's doing what he can to make the world a little bit better. Is that going to solve things? Oh, I wish it could, but not yet. There is coming a time though when God will bring a solution. Really will bring the solution. That's what we look forward to. So when James says he does not resist the evil, we would say not yet. Not yet. But there is coming a time when it will be made right. God is not stepping in to do anything yet. So if we have a time in our lives where we think God is just not stepping in, just always add the word yet. Because there is coming a time when he will resist the evil. He will make things right, not just for us personally, but for the world as a whole. And that's the time we look forward to. So we've gone a little bit over time. My apologies for that. We'll pick it up next time with Mr. Smith in verse 7. Get through probably the rest of the book, we hope, next time. So thanks for your time and attention.